Okay, welcome back.
That's right. So this afternoon we're going to begin a new chapter. We spent years thinking about spiritual resistance in the Holocaust from various vantage points. And now we're going to think about it perhaps in a different light as we begin thinking about Jewish values. Shea, why don't you stay on this side so you'll be closer to everybody? Meaning, how do we think about specifically Jewish values in light of the experience of the Holocaust? Right? Especially, you're using the exhibit as the platform to tell a story. Well, that story includes values, and you highlight different values during your presentation. When you take students through or guests through, whoever you're taking into the museum. So what we're going to do for the next several sessions is identify specifically Jewish values so that we can explore them, and then you can take them and apply them specifically in the Holocaust context. But I want to introduce that with a general observation about Jewish values and godliness in the world, which is if you look in the Chumash, if you look in the Bible, specifically in the five books, you will not find a list of values. You can Google today, list of values, and you'll get a whole host of them. Like, I don't know, what would you say? What would be at the top 10?
Charity, tzedakah.
Be charitable. What's another virtue you would put on there?
Specifically, Jewish church's moral
values. Well, the human values come from our neshama, which is, you know, partly universal, partly uniquely Jewish for us. Okay, but is that a value or a charge?
Also, mitzvot, for instance, would not be a value.
Exactly. That's what I'm noticing, that when you look in the Chumash, you find a whole lot of mitzvot. The word mitzvah means to connect and it means to command. But you don't find a whole lot of values. It doesn't say be gracious, be generous, be thoughtful, be supportive. It says, love your friend like yourself. And so the question that we can wonder is, why is it that it's very rare for the Chumash to say, for the Torah, for Hashem to instruct us to embody or consider a certain value? Rather, we're just told, act with this set of expectations from those you can glean. Yeah.
Case study.
Okay.
We have examples of the way people behaved in certain situations. Okay. What they held dear, and those are what we're emulating.
Okay, so great. So part one, then we'll
I was going to say, you know, the parsha this week, three angels come.
Beautiful.
You know, they're not angels, they're three people.
Right.
He doesn't know, but he goes up, and that's an example of hospitality.
Beautiful.
Okay, so that's this week's part. But we have to figure that out.
Okay.
Why does he do this?
Great. So that's half the answer is half of the question over here. So yes, part of the way to learn values is through modeling. So the book of Bereshis, tons of stories filled with models to learn values. But why is it in that way? So one way to think about this, there is a great book, phenomenal book by Adam Grant, who is a very popular author and speaker. He is an organizational psychologist. So he has a book called Give and Take.
This, just to go back to this original question, we're not a faith-based group.
So that's what we're trying to figure out. Why not? Why is it that
we
don't
do and observe?
Exactly. So why? Why is that? That's what I want to explore. Wow. Exactly.
Well, the Ten Commandments.
Right. They're not ten values.
No, they're not. They're saying, you worship me. I am the only God there is.
Okay.
Honor your parents.
Yes.
Definitely not a faith-based thing. You think you should honor your parents? No, it's up to you.
So that's what we want to understand why. So Adam Grant has an amazing Ha'ara observation in his book. There was a movement at one point in Harvard where the president of Harvard wanted to get the students to be more charitable, to be more generous, gracious. So he was going to have them sign a public pledge of kindness. So there was a very strong reaction to this. The students didn't want to be coerced into signing a pledge. But the bigger issue that they found when they did the research is that when someone signs up and signs a pledge and says, I am generous, that actually has no bearing on whether or not that person will in fact act generously at all. Quite the opposite. Sometimes it has the reverse. What's that? The person says, I don't need to give you, I'm already a generous person. Adam Grant makes the following observation. He says, when we're trying to influence someone, we often adopt an approach that mirrors the Harvard Pledge. We start by changing their attitudes, hoping that their behaviors are likely to march in the same direction. If we get people to sign a statement that they will act like givers, they'll come to believe that giving is important and they'll give. But according to a rich body of psychological detective work, this reasoning is backward. Influence is far more powerful in the opposite direction. Change people's behaviors first, and their attitudes will follow. To turn gift-takers into givers, it's often necessary to convince them to start giving. Over time, if the conditions are right, they'll come to see themselves as givers. Instead of telling people, be grateful, we tell them, honor your parents. And if you live a life of service to your parents, that will engender an experience and a value of generosity. We tell people, don't break the bones of the Paschal lamb. That's a law. If you were eating the Paschal lamb, you could not break the bones. Why not? You know what my mother used to tell me? Now she can't say it because she's not in my house when I'm eating. Or certainly not, you know, supervising. She would say, eat like a mensch. Right? Don't eat like a chazer. Eat like a mensch. You ever heard this?
Yes.
Right? So you could tell somebody from today till tomorrow, eat like a decent human being. Or you could tell them, here's the way to eat. Don't break the bones of the meat. What's that experience with your teeth? It means, don't eat so ravenously that you're biting through it. It means, eat like a mensch. But instead of saying it in the abstract, we give you a very specific prescription to help create that kind of experience. We don't tell people, be respectful. I don't know what being respectful means, but you know what we tell them? The Torah says, well, if you find a lost object, return it. And you're not allowed to steal. And it says in the later commentaries, you're not allowed to damage somebody. By the time you put all the laws together, you know what you come up with? The value of respecting someone else's property. Act like a mensch. Yeah.
Or, for example, don't take the chicken with its mother sitting there. If you wanted to save it for yourself, don't take it in her presence. Wait till she goes away. So that you get a sense of sensitivity.
Exactly. So the Talmud has a whole discussion about exactly this point, about the mother bird with the eggs and the issue of sensitivity. So I think we could spend a lot more time on this, but we're not going to. There is a whole world here of understanding how when Hashem gave us this gift called the Torah, He gave us laws and role models to teach us values. Because those are the most effective ways to communicate values.
Give stories.
Yes, so the modeling is through the stories.
Yeah.
And that's why the Chumash is a composite of two things. It's not a history book, and it's not, you know, it's not Aesop's fables, God forbid. It's a composite of stories and laws to teach us to become the kind of people that we can. And that is what I'd like to share with you over these sessions is, where do we find hints? How do we explore specific Jewish values now that we understand that that is a big part of Judaism? How do we look at them and think about them in our context here in the context of the Holocaust? So that's word of introduction. Today, I want to focus on a specific value, which it's complex. I think it's very complex. And there is a fascinating way of thinking about this, at least I think, and trying to figure out how do we apply it. And that is the value of courage. That's a very important value in educating about spiritual resistance in the Holocaust, about the role of Jews in the Holocaust, the role of people who survived the Holocaust. So many aspects of the story have to do with courage. So what does courage mean in a Jewish sense, and how do we draw on that? Well, what is the meaning of the word courage in the first place? It's a difficult term to define succinctly. Okay.
Risk has to be involved.
Okay, there's some potential definition here involving risk.
Behavior.
Behavior. So the Webster Dictionary, what's that?
Strength.
Strength, yes. So the Webster Dictionary defines courage as the ability to do something that you know is difficult or dangerous. Interesting.
That you know from experience, or you know from
intuitively,
what you've been told?
Intuitively.
Either one, right? And that's actually, to me, that definition really resonates. So now we're thinking about...
Is that difficult or...
Difficult or dangerous.
But there are things that are difficult that don't involve courage.
Okay. What do you mean?
It's difficult to go to graduate school. It's difficult to become a rabbi. It's difficult to, you know, to lead a tour. You're sick and you don't feel well, but you do your job anyway. I would describe those as courage.
Beautiful. So why not? What about them is or isn't courageous? Because this is what I want to drill down to.
You
want to
flesh that out?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a continuum of courage, though. And the courage is on there. It's on the continuum. Because I think at some level it's like courageous just to keep going, just to like wake up and, you know, for people that have social anxiety, to go like out, you know. And
I agree
to, like,
with
just,
you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. To get up, to give a speech may take a degree of courage. Even if you're well prepared, and it's a field you know, it's a risk. I keep coming back to it. It's a risk.
So is going to graduate school? No. Is going to graduate school? Is that a risk?
The risk is a
failure.
Okay. So
that's not a threat.
Well, is it or isn't it? What if someone has a low self-esteem? They have a low self-concept.
But tomorrow that esteem could suddenly appear.
Right, but when they apply, right?
Right.
Could that be a courageous thing?
Yeah. They don't believe in themselves. They don't believe they can do it.
So I wonder if there are different ways of thinking about the definition of courage. And then we can apply them in different episodes. And we can think about, does a man who dons tefillin walking to a labor site from their camp, does that qualify as courage?
You bet.
Right?
You bet.
How about someone who says Shema when they go into the gas chamber? Is that something of courage? Right? Where do we see these based on the definition of courage? So here's an interesting observation. Yeah.
Sharing a piece of bread with my friend.
Right.
Is courage? You bet.
Right?
You take so what you have as a salvation and share it with somebody else.
What about getting up in the morning in Auschwitz to go to work in Birkenau? Is that courage?
Yeah, because your option is don't get out of bed.
Ah, okay.
Cash it in, sign up. You know it's going to happen if you don't get out of bed.
So here are these are examples of what I think we could call two tiers or two aspects of courage. And these two aspects may be reflected in two different Hebrew words that relate to different aspects of our soul that God gave us that we employ in different circumstances. Now, where did the words come from for this idea? It's something that I've been thinking about because of a footnote. A footnote in this volume. This is called Moreh Nevuchim, which means Guide for the Perplexed. It was authored by That's right, Rambam Maimonides. Now, in the 38th chapter here, in the second section, the 38th chapter, he has a discussion about a value that we might call courage. But the footnote says, wait a second, how do you translate the word courage? He quotes Maimonides, who has two different Arabic words for this concept. One is akadam, which I'm probably mispronouncing, and the other one is shaja'a. You see how good my Arabic is. Why is this important? Because the footnote here is authored by a very important, great rabbinic personality who died not too long ago. His name is Rabbi Yosef Kapach. Rabbi Kapach was one of the world's greatest experts on Maimonides and Jewish learning, and specifically the realm of manuscripts. So he was a giant in the world of translating and analyzing Rambam's, Maimonides' original manuscripts, and he knew Arabic, and he went and did his own translation of many of the Rambam's, Maimonides' original works that were not published in Hebrew, like the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah and the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed. It was written in vernacular for people to read it. It wasn't just for rabbis and scholars. So he says, you have to look at the Arabic, Rav Kapach. And these two Arabic words are not the same. Interesting. He says, what is the way to look at this? This is in foot number one. He says, akadam is the Hebrew word that he chooses for that is ometz. Like we would say in the Chumash, it says, Moshe, Rabbeinu, Moses said to Yehoshua, to Joshua, he said, chazak ve'ematz. Ometz. That's one word. We could call that courage. What is ometz? That is what he calls lageshes ledavar lelo retia, to approach something without retia, means without hesitating, without stepping back, taking a step forward. That's ometz. That's one word. Ve'en la kesher, he says, that's not connected to a different word in Hebrew that we call gvura. What is gvura? Gvura could also be used to be the Hebrew translation of the word courage. So, for example, the 27th day of Nisan is Yom HaZikaron L'Shoah V'Ligvura. It is the day of remembrance in the state of Israel for the Knesset to remember the Shoah and the Gvura. In that context, it means courage. Two Hebrew words, two Arabic words, two aspects of courage, we can suggest. The first courage is the courage of ometz, is the ability to do something irrespective of the fear or the lethargy that would keep you from doing that. It's the ometz to get out of the barracks. That's also courageous, because the alternative is just to give up. Right? Unfortunately, there were people, we know that they were called, they had a nickname, Musulmen. What happened to them, Lo Aleinu? I mean, they gave up, they quit living. So physically they didn't expire yet, but they were not living. That wasn't necessarily that they chose to give up, but they didn't have any more omens. They didn't have any more ability to move on, to push forward. That's one kind of courage. This courage is the baseline to continue. And then there's the other level of courage. That level of courage comes from the word gvura, Gibor. What is a Gibor? Someone who's mighty. A Gibor, someone who's mighty. Ezehu Gibor, the Mishnah tells us, the rabbis teach us, who is a Gibor? Someone who is courageous. Hakovesh et Yitzro. What does the word lichbosh mean? Kovesh. What's that? To conquer, exactly. So someone, according to the rabbinic tradition, someone who conquers their inner demons is a gibor, is someone who is courageous. I used to think that the best definition for courage was gvura, which is oftentimes the contemporary way that we think of the word gvura, as in courage. But now I've come to understand with this nuance that these are two different kinds of courage. Because in a certain sense, you could argue that courage is primarily associated with kvisha, with conquering. It took tremendous courage for Abraham to take his son, his only son, his beloved son, and what? Put him on an altar. That takes courage. And that courage is the kvisha, is the conquering. But I think now there's another kind of courage. Because if the only definition of courage is the definition of the gibor who is kovesh, from the word gibor, is like from the word gavar. Gavar means to overwhelm, to cover up, to smother. What about somebody who just tries, even if they're not successful, in covering up, in conquering, in accomplishing? Is that also courage? If your only definition of courage is gvura, well then if you didn't conquer, then that's not courageous.
But you tried.
Oh, but if the definition of courage is what we would call in the Brisker terminology, there are two aspects of courage. There's the courage of gibor, of somebody who succeeds in conquering, but then there's the courage of the ometz, of just the ability to make the effort, to move forward. If we define courage with these two lenses, then that too is an act of courage. And what we have really, based, if you put these as two poles, what we have is a spectrum. It's not, do we say, did you check the courage box because you conquered or you didn't conquer, or because you moved forward or you didn't move forward. These are going to be points along a spectrum where maybe you didn't conquer the goal that you had, right? Maybe somebody's goal was to put on tefillin on the walk, and they didn't end up putting on tefillin. But the fact that they took it in their bag, the fact that they got to the walk in the first place, the fact that they continued to live, that's also an act of courage. Yeah.
I also think that conquering is a little subjective, because whose definition are we using? So in your example of getting out of bed and out, so if they get out of bed and they walk out the front door, they have already conquered.
Oh, exactly.
Right. So if their goal was to live through to the end of the world, I don't know. Like,
yes. So that's what I was just going to say. When you think of it as a spectrum, yeah. So then maybe you didn't get to that conquering, but maybe you just conquered your own fear. So in a certain sense, you can argue that these are two different concepts. In the other sense, you can really argue that they're one concept on a continuum. That ometz is a form of gvura. That just pushing forward is conquering the demons that say give up. This is true, and we're trained to this in the in the halachic sense. The Torah guides us to have the courage to be able to stand up to fear. When soldiers would go out to battle, so the Rambam, Maimonides, codifies that there was actually a commandment not to fear the enemy. They would have a special speech to give people a pep talk, get them going, and motivate them to conquer their fears. Because it's important to be able to move forward, especially when you're in a battle. But it's not just when you're talking about a battle that you have to motivate people. Of course, it exists on a micro level, on a personal level, on a soulful level. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik has an essay called Catharsis. And there he talks about the role of the halakha, the way of Jewish law. And he talks about how, on the one hand, the halakha can be very tender, understanding, and accommodating. On the other hand, sometimes the halakha can demand tremendous courage and sacrifice and an ability to do things that are difficult, even what he calls things that are, you could argue, is impossible. The halakha calls upon you to do those. That is an act of religious omets or religious gvura. This is where we can turn the tables a little bit. Where is it that you can find an episode or a story that reflects omets or gvura in your work, in the tour that you give, in the talk that you give? Where would you express that? Okay.
Say you're challenged by one of your guests.
Great.
In some factor. Can you take the challenge and rise enough to convince the person that they've been misled, or that what they know to be the truth is not really the truth?
Right.
And so you're facing a guest, and you have to be careful on how you say that. Such a manner as you're not deluding, and then at the same time you want them to listen to what you're saying and understand where you're coming from. You have to know the subject well enough to know that you can be convincing without being, without banging, I don't know the right word for it, without harshly hurting them or embarrassing them in front of everybody else.
Or to even sometimes we need to be, as educators, courageous enough to say, I don't know. And that's also okay.
Yes,
right?
So.
Well, what about within the work of the museum? What does the word Holocaust come from?
Greek.
Right, from what? What does the origin
fire
mean? Fire. Who was a man who was willing to be thrown in a fire? There's a Midrashic tradition of Abraham. What's that?
I remember that a long time ago, but I can't tell you the story.
Right?
I don't know well enough.
Okay, now you're going to pull the deep recesses.
Yeah.
The tradition is that Abraham was thrown into a fire in a place called Ur Kasdim, Ur of Chaldean. Why? Because the entire society, they were pagans, and Abraham believed in monotheism. So he had the courage to stand up for his convictions, even though it meant that he was going to be thrown into the furnace. Think of how many episodes of people who, let's say, Dr. Korczak, did he know what was going to happen to him? He knew exactly what was going to happen to him, right? And yet, he had this unique courage to stand up and push forward. In that case, it meant sacrificing his life, not to leave his orphan children, the children from his orphanage, to go with them wherever they went, he was going, and he probably knew very well exactly what was going to happen to them and what was going to happen to him. But that is the Jewish value. Now, in the case of Abraham, he survived the furnace through this miraculous divine intervention. In the case of, as we know, so many millions, they didn't survive that furnace. But if courage is being able to do something that is difficult, and it's on this spectrum of just moving forward to, on the other side, Gibor, conquering your most basic drive, which is to live, and to literally be kovesh. Kovesh means to conquer, means to crush, and to wrestle that down and say, despite that, I will go. Or another similar type of thing, Rev Michel Ber Weissmandel, who's on a train that's going to Auschwitz from Czechoslovakia, from Hungary. Forget exactly what the point of departure was. And he has to make a choice. Does he stay on the train with his wife and his children? Or does he jump off the moving train and walk back to Czechoslovakia and rejoin the underground and leave his own children to die? And he chooses to jump from the train, a decision that haunted him for the rest of his life. So there, he is kovesh. He is doing something obviously dangerous. Of course it's dangerous. The jumping, the running away, the being caught, the being shot, everything. Obviously it's dangerous. But the ability also to suppress his own feelings for his own children so that he could do something for the benefit of the community, for the benefit of others, that's unbelievable gvura. That's on the most extreme side. But then you could argue on the omet side, then I'll get to you in 1 second, Mickey. You have somebody who's going to the gas chambers, and they know that they're at the end anyway. But they still choose to say Shema. That too is courage. That's the courage of the omets. Did they conquer something? Probably they conquered some things, but it's not about the conquering. They didn't come out alive. But they were able to move forward, to move their soul forward, to be true to themselves on a soul level. That's also omens. That's also courage. To choose that's going to be your last act on this earth, we can't imagine what level of courage that is too. So it's not, and this is what I wanted to for you to consider, and then you can take it back now and kind of process it on your own. It's not that courage is only one definition. From a Torah standpoint, courage is an expansive definition because it's on this spectrum between omets and gvura. Yeah, what were you going to add?
Oh, no, I just had an example.
Yeah, please.
I was just thinking when you were saying that, it automatically went to all the Jews living in Germany that had to make that decision to push themselves forward to try to leave. And we see so much of how that thought process evolved and evolved, but how much courage that took for them to see a future somewhere else and to start leave everything behind, to start again, and while all of them display courage, not everyone actually got on that ship. You know, so
exactly, that's this continuum. So this is just one example. Yeah.
The more so, you know,
yes.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where does hope come in? Because
okay.
People know they're taking chances, yeah, of risking, and they get hope.
So that's what it's kind of alluding to, one of the earlier points of the ability to do something that you know is difficult or dangerous means that there is inherent risk. There's a risk factor in courage. And on the omet side, that risk factor is failing ourselves, disappointing ourselves. And on the gvura side of the equation, it's literally the risk of life and death. And so in any given circumstance, how we define courage is subjective. It's not going to be objective. Because for one person, omet's type of courage would be to say, don't revolt, survive, try to manage for another day. That's also a kind of courage. Right, this is part of that debate about the quote-unquote sheep to the slaughter. That's not sheep to the slaughter. That's one kind of courage. That's omet's type of courage. That's the courage that says we're going to keep moving forward and try to survive another day. Maybe the Russians will come. Maybe God will save us. Maybe a miracle will happen. Maybe we'll be able to sneak out. Whatever it is. And then there's the other side, which is the gvura side of it, which says, no, we're going to pick up arms. The Germans have panzer divisions and we have, you know, sticks. Doesn't matter, even though there's a risk, and that risk is the high likelihood of being killed, that's the best way to go. So who are we to say which one has more courage? Right? The answer is they both involve courage. The courage of continuing on and trying to make a life despite these most impossible circumstances, that's courage. The courage to pick up a weapon and take on the most powerful, well, arguably, thank God they weren't in the end, you know, but to take on the Germans and fight them and take that huge risk. Both of those involve aspects of courage. And that was part of the debate. That's the different ways of looking at how you understand, at least to the extent that we can, which we really fully can't, but to the extent of understanding what the debate was, especially within the religious community, as to whether or not people should cooperate with the Germans or they should fight back. And there were two different opinions, as we talked about in the past. But what we're arguing today is that both of them are acts of courage. There's one type of courage, one side of it, that's the ometz, that's moving forward, and then there's the other type of courage, which is the courage of gevura, of conquering and accomplishing your goal.
How do you distinguish between how we just define courage and then that the definition, let's say,
of
resistance?
So resistance to me, I'm not sure, but resistance to me sounds more of an external measurable phenomenon, at least on some level, as opposed to courage as a personal quality, right? You wouldn't say that that person was resistancy, right? You would say that that person was courageous and their courage took the form of resistance, right? Courage, right? So, yeah, the courage, yes, yes. So the ability to resist spiritually is a courageous act. It's the courage that people had within them. They tapped into that spiritual courage to be able to do that. It took great courage to resist, right? The courage is the divine quality of the soul that God gave the person that they draw upon to live a life of resistance. Yes, it's the resistance is the expression of the courage. Yeah.
When I